Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That welcome was from our founder, Brian Brown, and you are listening to the Brown Briefly. It's Tuesday, October 10th. I've jumped ahead several months. August 10th, 2021. This morning, we have six Brieflies gathered via the magic of Zoom to discuss local, state, and national news and nonsense. We aim for honest, civil discussions based in truth and integrity. Welcome, our Georgia peach, Lynn Kerrigan, isn't with us this morning, out ill. We wish her well. But we have Captain of the Airways, Truman O'Brien, activists and Clark Kent lookalike, Kevin Jones, and historian, also known as the Guardian of the Galaxy, Bruce Holman. And I'm Gail Kellner, your host for this week's program. And we have a special summer guest with us today, Grace McRae. Welcome, Grace.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Well, just to tell our listeners a little bit about Grace, she is currently a public opinion researcher with the Sierra Club. She resides in Burton Peninsula there with her daughter and husband, and she arrived about 3 years ago from Washington, D.C., where she worked as a public opinion researcher with the Hillary Clinton campaign and others. Well, welcome so much, Grace. We're really happy to have you this morning. Tell us a little about your relationship to our fair island, once described by someone as 39 acres of paradise surrounded by reality. And there's a bumper sticker you may have seen that reads, "Keep Vachon Weird." So I'm curious, what did you find most interesting, weird, or hard to get used to when you first arrived to Vachon?
Well, I guess I'd say I've had a little taste of Vachon for a long time now. My husband, Kevin, his parents have had a house on Maury Island for about 30 years. So he's been coming here and spending summers and weekends on Vachon since he was very small. And so when I first started dating him maybe 12, 13 years ago, pretty quickly got exposed to Vachon and would get a week here, a weekend there type of exposure to Vachon. So it got me kind of built up. So I knew what I was getting into mostly when I moved here to be a full-time islander. Definitely some learning curves, but I think a few things that immediately stuck out to me. So I came from, as you mentioned, downtown Washington, D.C., a few blocks away from the White House. And I just couldn't get over the sense of community on Vachon, as well as the sense of trust on Vachon, which maybe also because I've never lived in a small town. But like the farm stands, for example, I loved going around to all the farm stands, and the fact that everything was the honor system kind of blew my mind, because, you know, you don't leave anything out unaccounted for on the streets of Washington, D.C. If you care about it. So that was quite a culture shock, but a very welcome one.
Great. Thanks, Grace, for sharing that. I might also like to share with our listeners that Grace does a show on Voice of Vachon on Tuesday evenings, I believe it airs, and it's called Inspired Island. Do you want to tell us just a little bit about your show?
Sure. Yeah, it's been a great way to get to know people on the island because I've been so impressed with the breadth of skills and interests and passions that people on Vachon have. I started the show Inspired Island a couple years ago to basically be a mini spotlight on individuals on Vachon who have different passions and interests. And there's no shortage of cool people to interview on Vachon. And actually two folks here, Bruce and Truman, have been interviewed. So you can find their recordings on the Voice of Vachon website. We have them all archived there. So those are both great interviews.
And I have to say that was really fun, Grace. You do a great job of interviewing, and I felt very comfortable and very at home. As I remember, we were up at Sunrise Ridge, right in the little studio Yeah.
Correct.
So quite a different feel to it. How about you, Bruce?
Oh, it was great fun. Yeah. We actually were in the studio, the Gene Bosch studio.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, Truman, yours must have been before the great treetop landing that you
had. Yes, it was, actually. Yes.
Time for Grace to re-interview you.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
That's right. A good reprise.
Well, I have to tell you also, though, that Grace's husband is a phenomenal pilot, and he and I have flown together a fair amount, and just a great guy. And he's fairly a new pilot, but boy, he is very, very competent. I was really impressed with him. So
that Grace, makes me feel more comfortable flying with him. Truman's yeah. Stamp of approval.
Okay. Well, great. Well, I'd like to kind of start our show off with a little bit of good news. So I wondered what each of you had come across this week in our local state or otherwise that you'd like to share this morning. Kevin, since we haven't heard from you yet.
I saw a raindrop.
Yes!
About three, actually.
It was like, hey, manna from heaven. It was really nice to see cooler mornings, and we sort of put that in the bank, you know, because of our warmer weather that's going to be coming up here. But we're also I'm doing a project out to replace the deck deck boards on the deck on our house, and it's a juggling act of all the plantings. They're on wheelies, right? So you can roll these big planters around. So they're all on one side of the deck while I'm replacing the boards on one side, and then I roll them over to the other side to tear off and replace those deck boards. But all the animals, the squirrels and the chipmunks and the birds, are becoming undeterred now by my presence. And I had a nuthatch almost land on my shoulder the other day, and a hummingbird, which was probably a foot away from my left ear, as I'm doing the work around the flowers and on the deck. So it's been really great to be that connected to the little animals and such that are wandering and flying around.
Oh, thanks for sharing that. Yeah, it is true. It's truly a tonic for the soul in any time, but particularly, I think, in these trying times, that connection with nature. Bruce, how about you? What news have you come across this
week? Well, I thought it was very good news, or it makes me feel very good to live on Vashon and in Washington State when our governor has come out and taken a very assertive and aggressive position on COVID and on the Delta variants, and also watching, and this is very encouraging to me, watching the school superintendents and mayors in Texas and Florida stand up to the governors who are in denial about COVID. And so I think there's hope in our nation that, you know, not everybody is going to be overwhelmed by the DeSantis and Abbotts of the world who want to deny that COVID's actually here and that it's coming back in a virulent form. So I'm very, very happy to be in Washington State. And, you know, whether you like Governor Inslee or not, and many people have issues with Governor Inslee, he's been a dynamic leader when it comes to COVID.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I have to agree.
Thank you. Go ahead, Truman.
Yeah, one thing that just bothers me, I have, as you all know, I have some of these super right-wing friends on Facebook, and lately I've been reading, it's all a hoax. And I mean, and they're finding experts in quotes to back up their claims. And it just drives me crazy. I just don't even know how to respond to them. You know, you just feel like they're such fools, you know, for going for that. Yeah. Kevin.
You know, it's, I share the concern. You know, at one time it was a challenge for us to deal with COVID. No vaccinations, masking was clearly a change of lifestyle, social distancing, places shutting down, and the people who experienced a backlash, concerns about that were clearly disrupted in their lives, and you had to feel, you know, some sense of empathy. It's hard for me to understand why now in the world where we have millions of people now who've been vaccinated, very few instances of any problems, that there are those who will persist. On, you know, here on Vashon, we have a strong community that's against vaccinations. I've been heard some local commentary, some concerns about that, you know, the other day. Well, actually quite a few over the last couple weeks. So it's perplexing to me. Yeah. And I share your concern, yeah. Truman. And I heard a commentator the other day on the news, I think it was a healthcare provider, saying, you know, the reality is some people just have to see a family member suffer before it becomes real for them. Yeah. And, you know, people are people. So some of us folks are in that mindset, and others, and hopefully more of us will be thinking about the consequences of actions and taking precautions.
Indeed. Now, my bit of good news. There was some good news for me this week. I got my airplane back from the paint shop.
Yay!
And it came out absolutely phenomenal. The best paint job I think I've ever seen. It was worth every penny. And there were several of those pennies spent.
The only problem I have, Truman, is you painted it in the colors of the New England Patriots.
I know.
The Seahawks. So come on.
That was the first.
How did that slip through?
I don't know. That was the first thing that I heard. Somebody said, "Oh, nice New England Patriot paint job." I went, "Oh no, I can't believe I didn't think of that." But it is pretty.
Don't let it deter you.
Yeah, yeah. That's all right. Gives me incentive to keep it out of the trees anyway. So.
Well, good. How about you, Grace? Any good news that you picked up on particularly this week?
Well, there's a lot of news out there, but I think something that left me really inspired this weekend was witnessing, it was the 51st anniversary of the Penn Cove capture of southern resident killer whales up in Whidbey. So basically here on Vashon, we get the real pleasure of getting sightings of the southern resident killer whales, who are an endangered species, but they'll swim by like Point Robinson, et cetera. So I've definitely, being an animal lover to begin with, I've definitely become really interested in the challenges they're up against. And this weekend there were a whole set of different events, and I listened into some, but what I really loved is it's an area where I've been seeing a lot of collaboration and working together and learning from one another in terms of the affiliated tribes of the Northwest, and including like the Lummi Island Nation, the Lummi Nation, and sort of animal rights activists, et cetera. So they were both commemorating and remembering the Penn Cove capture, which was, I think they took seven young killer whales, and then they sent them out to captivity, including one is still alive at the Miami Seaquarium. And so the event was a lot about like remembering the fact that she's still around, her family is in dire trouble. But well, the content was really sad and upsetting. I really thought it was amazing to see so many different groups across the state come together to hold these virtual meetings. And I guess that's a benefit of this move to virtual events, is the fact that we're able to connect with people that we may not always be able to connect with. So yeah, that left me feeling a little inspired.
Great.
One of the benefits that's come out of COVID, I think, truly is this collaboration. That, I mean, look at us, you know, doing Zoom. I mean, doing our Brown Briefly on Zoom. We've been doing it now for what, a year and a half or so, and mm-hmm. It works. It works so well, and you're able to bring people in without much effort. And I think that's been a real benefit.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bruce.
If I can pick up on that concept of collaboration and what Grace was talking about. The Heritage Museum right now in the back area has the Whale People exhibit that's going on through the end of August. And on Friday and Saturday evenings from 8 to 10, we're actually showing the projection in the round and the sound system of the Whale People exhibit. And the whale, the killer whale itself, it sits in the center, was carved by the House of Tears carvers from the Lummi nation. And of course, you know, at the end of July, we had the Red Road poll here on Vashon before it began its journey back to Washington, D.C., where it has now arrived at the Smithsonian. But also, it's a collaboration. So it's not just the Heritage Museum, but it's the Natural History Museum here on Vashon. It's Vashon Nature Center. Audubon has worked with us, put in a natural habitat garden. You know, so there's just lots of things going on that are collaborative on the island. And that's one of them that resonates with what you were talking about, Grace, in terms of recognizing the importance of the resident, southern resident killer whales to the island and to the place that we live.
Mm-hmm. I have a friend who was out on a whale watching trip last week, and he shared with me that the tour that he was on remained a very respectful distance from the whales. So they were, he said they were about 1,000 feet away, which is about where they should be, 600 to 1,000 feet away. And he felt a sense of kind of pride that they weren't interfering with the whales. That, yeah, there's those who want to get closer to get a better look, but his feeling was, wow, we're not disrupting their feeding or just their daily life. So I think that there's beginning to be some changes in that area, and I'm happy to see that.
You know, I'm sure, Kevin, you've been up to the San Juans a lot and you've seen the whale watching boats, but I kind of felt like they've always done a pretty decent job of keeping their distance, you know, the ones we've seen anyway.
Yeah, it's been quite a controversial, having lived up there the last, you know, three or 4 years, I can say that it's been quite a controversy up there about the distance, and some have and some haven't, but the standard seems to be holding at about a minimum of 600 feet, which is very different than the 200 or 400 feet was common some years ago.
Yeah. One thing I have to tell you, several years ago, I was taking my boat into Seattle to be worked on, and we're up by the West Point, and I saw something flash, you know, splash in front of me, and I looked, and I thought, oh my gosh, is that a whale? And suddenly I realized that there was a pod coming at us, and I just shut down immediately, and before I knew it, they were all around us, and that's the only time that's ever happened to me. But we had a big, big male come right by the boat and kind of rolled up and looked at us, and my friend that was with me just about crawled in my lap because this thing is huge and was very close to the boat. So I really appreciate the size of those things and the proximity. Kevin?
Yeah, it's interesting. We were running down out of Johnstone Strait in the fog some years ago and going slow. And over the radio, we were hailed. There was not much traffic out there at the time that we were out. And this is up in Canada, quite a bit north of Nanaimo. And the person on the radio said, hey, by the way, did you know that you're approaching two whales that live here in our bay? And it was the operator of a whale watching tour boat. Oh. And it was like that was his extended family, these whales. And it was very gratifying to see that he alerted me, because of the fog, there was really no way to see more than, I mean, it was really quite thick, maybe a few hundred feet. Mm-hmm. And so that was helpful. But I think as Gail mentioned, you know, it's quite a variation in terms of people respecting the limitations that are really important so that the whales hopefully can recover. And so many other environmental issues, of course, that are tied up in their survival as well. But that's certainly one of them.
Well, it seems like an appropriate segue to our next segment, where I think all of you probably have seen, and hopefully our listeners are aware, that yesterday the United Nations released a climate report. What aspects struck the Briefleys? I'd like to hear maybe from each of you and a bit of a discussion around that very significant document that was released. Grace, I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you start us off?
Sure. Well, having worked for an environmental organization and I studied environmental studies in college, I've been paying attention to the IPCC, so International Panel on Climate Change, which is affiliated with the United Nations. I've been reading their reports or summaries of the reports. They're usually quite dense and quite long. The science reports as they come out, I think the last one was, I can't remember off the top of my head, I think like 7 years ago, it was a while ago. And this one definitely had, it seems significant in that past reports that I've read, science reports, was oftentimes talking about like future impacts. And if you read the summaries and the takeaways from this report, and again, it's a science report. So it's based on, I think, like 200 research, climate researchers were involved in this report. It talks about like current existing impacts to an extent that I haven't seen yet before. So yeah, it is definitely striking me different. And I definitely haven't read the full report. I think it's over 100 pages long. I think even the summary is like 42 pages. So it's quite dense. There's a lot there. But I think it's a bit of a mixed bag in terms of it's definitely quite sobering to read as somebody who cares about environmental issues and social issues, as well as it does offer some, you know, glimmer of hope. Like there is some sort of window to avoid the worst consequences, but the consequences are already underway. But it would require some serious collaboration and some serious big scale changes in order to stop emissions of carbon. And this report focuses a lot on methane, which I don't think past reports have focused as much on methane. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, but I'm eager to hear what others' reactions have been.
You know, one comment about the methane, you know, flying in Alaska, which I did a lot, with the warming that's occurring, they're finding that, you know, there's a considerable exposure of methane from the permafrost as this begins to melt. And, you know, this is a huge area. I mean, Siberia and all of the Arctic. As this warms, there's not much you can do about it. I mean, from the methane point of view, we can slow the climate, the warming down by doing the things that we're doing, the carbon by keeping the carbon connected. Anyway, I think that's a really a dangerous thing that's happening. And another one of the small fishing coastal fishing villages is beginning to wash away up there, and that was happening while it was there. And again, that's rising ocean levels. So
yeah. Bruce, Kevin, what are your thoughts?
I think one of the things that struck me was people's response to it, how many people came out saying effectively that there's still time to make changes. And my sense is that that timeline is getting increasingly short, and we don't seem to be making any of the kinds of significant changes that it's going to take to alter what's already underway. And like Truman mentioned, you read some of the scientists who work with methane and work in the Arctic, and I mean they're scared, really basically scared of what's happening in the Arctic, all the way around the Arctic with the permafrost and the methane escaping. And methane's a very, very high sort of greenhouse gas, you know, very potent greenhouse gas. It's sort of what strikes me is it's pushing us more and more toward that, looking for that scientific solution. You know, how are we going to cure this problem with you know, technology? And on a global basis, that strikes me as short-sighted. I'm not sure there is a technological fix for this. On a personal basis, I have a 3-year-old and a 6-7-year-old grandsons living right across the street. So we see them every day. And, you know, I'm at an age where, you know, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years from now, it's not going to be my problem. But for a 3-year-old, they're going to be in their 20s and I really get concerned about what the world is going to be like and what how they're going to be able to deal with what's happening with global climate change, because it's coming and it's coming fast.
You know, one of the things that that I try and, I mean, to my deniers that I know, of course, and there are many, I try and say to them, you know, whether or not we can do anything about it is one thing, but to not plan for what's happening is absolutely ludicrous. I mean, we know that this is happening, whether we can affect it or not, but there's folks who are saying that, oh, the military, you know, the military doesn't have to worry about that. But boy, I mean, all of our military bases and are going to be highly affected. And those folks who are you know, super right-wing folks, that the military is a big deal for them. They better be paying attention. And that's what I try and get across to them is let's at least look at what's happening, whether we can affect it or not.
Yeah, military leaders certainly see it as a threat and have
Absolutely.
For some time.
Absolutely.
It's not only a threat to the bases and certainly the waterfront, low-lying bases, island bases, and in those strategic places across the Pacific, but it also has impact on their ability to continue operations as the world needs to reduce the carbon pollution. And they're, you know, like
Big
many
polluters.
Of us, they're another source, right, of pollution. I didn't expect to see good news in the UN climate report. I didn't read the report. I did read a summary. There's some sort of startling statements. Running out of time was one of those. They talked about the budget to keep to 1.5 degrees. We're going to go past that in about a decade. The other thing, seas will rise no matter what. I recall hearing a person on Vashon saying that when they replaced the North End dock, they didn't raise it up. So the climate change is a hoax because they would have raised it if climate change was real. On the other hand, if you look at our Vashon Climate Action Group logo, the logo shows a distortion of Vashon and Maury Islands because we're showing the sea level, the coastline 50 years from now. As the water has risen and Portage is now underwater. And it's threatened quite often with water now over the roadway in Portage.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a couple things that, of course, people can do. The King County, unincorporated King County building codes are being considered that would, for new commercial and multifamily construction, would require improved building efficiency. And buildings emit a tremendous amount of carbon pollution through heating and cooling and all their energy needs. And so on the 24th or 25th of this month, people have an opportunity to testify or go to a hearing on that with King County. If you email me, kevin@indivisiblevashon.org, I will make sure that you're on that list, folks who want to hear more about that. And the Vashon Island, Vashon Maury Island Community Council meeting this month, we'll have a summary presentation of the UN report, as well as a report that I'll summarize our work with our utility to move them away from carbon sources, to address methane leaks, which is 87 times higher global warming potential than carbon dioxide. So it is a very serious greenhouse gas. So there's definitely ways to get on board and contribute, as Grace certainly knows. Vashon Maury Island Community Council meeting is another great place to spend a little bit of time. Look on their website and find the meeting, join us, and hear what else you can do.
Great. Thanks for that, Kevin. I think it is important that just for our mental health, that we remember there are actions that we can take in our personal choices, as well as exerting political pressure on our leaders to begin and continue to make the steps necessary for change. Because change is coming one way or another. So, you know, we're going to have to face that. And hopefully the change that we make now will protect those grandchildren that, you know, Grace, you have little children, I have children. In their 20s, several of us have children in their, and it isn't, and it's not just our own species, our own children, but it's the community of animals and plants that makes up this beautiful living earth, and it's so important that we protect that as much as we can. Okay, go ahead, Grace. Yeah.
And if I could just add an acknowledgement that, you know, here on Vashon, we're pretty privileged in terms of, even though we are experiencing climate impacts, there's a lot of parts of the country, parts of the world that are going to get it and are getting it worse. And there's, you know, lots of research out there that shows that frontline communities, including communities of color, people living with disabilities, lower income communities, are really going to be bearing the brunt. So those of us who do have financial resources, time resources, et cetera, I would just urge all of us to think about what unique ways we can get involved too. You may have skills that look a little bit different, but you may have some brainstorm different ways to get involved outside of just the usual ones. So I would just urge people to be creative and use your own skills to get involved here.
Thank you for that. Okay, well, let's move on to our next subject. I have long been a proponent of a 4-day work week, but not 10 hours a day, but to cut us back to something more reasonable. I've for a long time watched as I see women in particular just working so hard when they, especially if they have a family, to care for children's and then to care for a home, the shopping, the cooking, the cleaning, you know, the bills. And then on top of it, many of them are juggling a job or two. So I've wondered, is a 40-hour work week a dinosaur? Do we need to move on? Let some things go extinct. Bruce, maybe you can talk to us, give us a little historical background on the 40-hour work week, and then I'd maybe hear from a few others.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, Australia led the way in the 1880s and 1890s with what was called the 888 movement. So the idea of 8 hours of work, 8 hours of recreation, 8 hours of sleep. A dream for all of us, I know. But at the same time, I mean, that became sort of the underlying assumption of much of the early labor movement in the late 19th and early 20th century. But in my sense is the 40-hour week it has long disappeared. I mean, you know, the 40-hour week was really focused on individuals who were working in sort of wage jobs. You know, in labor sort of union type jobs. And even those have drastically changed the nature of what work is. I mean, I was very encouraged. I think it was just last week I heard the report that the average restaurant worker's wage is now above $15 an hour in the United States. Now, that's not equally spread throughout the nation, but that's a significant change. And I think part of that's the result of the pandemic. The pandemic is essentially readjusting what people's expectations of work are and what even work is. And that's not untypical of past pandemics. You know, the Black Death, you know, in Europe drastically readjusted the nature of work in medieval society, because there were very few peasants left to work the land, and all of a sudden landowners, you know, the gentry, if you will, had to readjust their thinking about what it meant to have servants and to have people working in fields and things like that. So this pandemic, which in my estimation is far from over, is having that kind of sort of a major sort of meta influence on what we consider work and how we work. I mean, look at us right here. We're all working in five different spaces, and yet we're in one space, in a virtual space. And I really think that that's what we're going to see in the future, is that work, 40-hour week, it has been dead for a long time. Many people work 80 or 90 hours.
I was just going to say that.
It's adjusted up.
But the idea of compensation for work is what we're really talking about, not about how long you work, but what you get paid for what you work and how you work. And that has changed dramatically. And I think it's going to continue to change dramatically.
Yeah, I think one of the things about this virtual business is that we, not me, but in general are working more, working longer hours. So now it's a different kind of work, but I mean, the folks that are out there swinging hammers and pounding nails, those guys are working the 40-hour week. But anybody who does anything on desk work, I think they're working a heck of a lot more than 40 hours. Kevin.
Yeah, and I was thinking about the shifting economy of the U.S. and how the history of the 40-hour work week, because certainly, you know, if Michael Shook was here with us today, he'd talk about the crew, right? They go out and build homes or other buildings. And, you know, it's hard to move those big, you know, 2x12x20-foot beams on your own. You need somebody else to hang on. So, you know, some labor is by nature, right, communal, where you need to have the multiple people there physically on site manufacturing, for example. Well, clearly that is a trend in this country, you know, bemoaning a loss by many. But there's also the shift towards knowledge work, which I think is a lot more flexible. And the beauty of technologies like Zoom that do allow the collaboration, like we were talking about earlier, the ability to not pollute the atmosphere by having to be at one spot to do this kind of work, for those of us who don't have, you know, non-emitting vehicles. So, I think that the flexibility is good, but I have to admit I'm a recovering 50-hour week, pretty regular. But you know, retirement hasn't really changed the amount of time and things that I do, but it has definitely changed the way I do them.
And Grace, how about you? You're working remotely, right? Primarily.
I am. And I was hybrid working remotely even before the pandemic, being on Vashon. The commute to my office downtown door to door was about an hour and 30 minutes each way. So wow. I know some people do that 5 days a week, but even before the birth of my daughter, Luana, that it was just a little bit much for me. And I think in terms of thinking about like all these, also the younger generations, having some sort of flexibility or like unique work scheduling does seem to be almost baked into now what some workers, again, you know, it depends on what industry you're working on, are looking for. So I know like right now working for a nonprofit, where I work, there is a lot of flexibility in terms of, you know, if you need to start a little bit later to go to an appointment, et cetera. I've worked at other places where, you know, you need to clock in at 9 and clock out at 5. But I actually really like a little bit of flexibility and leeway in terms of the work day, particularly now being a new parent and having to deal with doctor's appointments and all that. And I've become accustomed to it. So to be honest, I'm not sure if I would be chomping at the bit to go back to a very rigid 9-to-5 schedule. And I can't think that I'm alone in that.
No.
So I think this remote working is opening some more doors for some flexibility. But again, I'm married to somebody who's working a whole lot more due to working remote than he used to. So it's a tricky one, but it's fascinating to watch.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, that flexibility is super important. The last 10 years or so of my career, my work life, my boss was fine with me getting into the office at 6:30 in the morning and leaving at 2:30. And so that was able to cut my 1.5 hour each way commute down to, you know, sometimes an hour and 10 minutes if you got there at the boat just right. But that's a challenge of Vashon. And I think the reason that Vashon does have that intriguing mix of different talents, because there are not a lot of people who are willing to put up with that kind of commitment, right, to commuting. And so finding creative ways to address that is, I think, part of what creates the Vashon that we have. But finding flexibility is really super important. I have a niece who works in her offices in Boulder. She lives in Reno, and she visits the office about one day a month. And everything else is remote. So there's ways.
I think there's some efficiencies that are found with this remote. I mean, if your workforce is more relaxed and happier, they're going to be more efficient and more productive. You know, so, I mean, it just kind of makes sense that that there's a benefit to that.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Truman. I think that when people are able to do self-care for themselves and their families, there's a lot less stress that they're under, and I think that translates into a happier worker. And the other thing that I think it's definitely impactful is for women in particular, because a flexible schedule, if you have children, is a must. And that very thing has driven women out of the workforce for years, for decades, because there's just was no way to juggle so many demands and needs. And when you have a flexible work schedule, that changes everything in terms of women being able to continue with working and their careers and not having to give that up. So I can speak from personal experience on that one. So I am really appreciative of this understanding. And I think that brings us to the topic a little bit about what's going to come this year. Will we go back? Schools are not only providing education for our students, but they provide the all-important childcare. And what's going to happen if they're not able to open as expected? You know, Bruce, your children must be facing that question with though going back into Vashon schools. Grace, your daughter is younger, but that's a question to come. Would you send her in, you know, given the risks involved and others? I'd love to hear from you.
There was a fascinating study that just came out yesterday about the efficacy of masks in schoolrooms. It was done, a pretty extensive study done in North Carolina. And what they found is that children in classrooms wearing masks were very effective against transmission of COVID. Now, this was done before Delta became the major kind of vector for transmitting COVID. So they're going to have to redo that study, I think, with Delta in mind. But it's the idea that if schools are set up and run in a way that they maximize student safety, that there's not a need to go back to the total kind of online learning that we had over the past year. My guess is that what we're going to see, until we know more about Delta and its transmissibility in closed environments, is that we're going to see hybrid kinds of schools. There's lots and lots of pushback coming from teachers and from parents, not wanting students in closed classrooms. So it's going to be very interesting to see, and particularly in those states like Texas and Florida and in the South, where there's, you know, governmental regulations against wearing face masks in school. You know, if I were a parent, I would be giving the middle finger to those governors, very frankly, and just saying, hey, my kid's going to wear a mask, and every other kid in the room, or my kid's not going to be there.
But, you know, the big thing about the Delta variant is that the viral load, and the viral load is still going to be what it is. The mask is going to limit the viral load. And I guess the problem is that the Delta variant can bring about illness with a lower viral load, is the idea. That's why it's so much more transmissible. But even then, I mean, the mask still is a mask. I mean, it's going to cut down on that load. So,
just being a mother, I can say that I would have a hard time and probably would not send my children to school. I have to say, unless I felt 100% sure that they were not going to be affected by that. And not just because I would be afraid for them for getting a single illness, but because of particularly long-term COVID, you know, the lasting effects of it. I don't believe I, as a mother, would risk that. How about you, Grace? What are your thoughts?
I mean, this is actually sparking a lot of new thinking on my end. Luckily, this has been all hypothetical with a one-year-old at home. I mean, to be honest, with COVID, I've been mostly thinking about the school issues from a daughter's perspective. My mother is a public school teacher in Massachusetts, and she's close to retirement. I mean, she only has about a year or two left to teach before she retires. And while, knock on wood, overall, she's very healthy, she does have a couple issues that just make her a little extra concerned about COVID. She's vaccinated now, but I think her plan is to go back into the classroom because that's kind of what the school district is doing. But yeah, that's a lot of added stress to an already stressful, underpaid, as we know, public school teachers, are already under a lot of stress. So that's pretty much what I've been thinking about a lot of these issues from. So trying to figure out how to make it, if kids are going to be back in school, as safe as possible. But I know my mom on the mask issue is, you know, she's teaching first graders. So to get first graders to uniformly follow any direction is a little bit challenging. So
they don't tie their shoes, as I recall, as a teacher, let alone wear a mask. Hey, thank you, everybody. And I think I'm getting the signal from Truman.
Yep, we got to go. Show.
And stay safe out there. And thank you, Briefly, for joining us.
And thank you, Grace, very much. Grace.